This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. Neil Conan is away. The accusations are both horrible and familiar. Bishop Eddie Long, pastor of an Atlanta church with a congregation 25,000 strong, faces allegations from four young men that he coerced them into sexual relationships. We want to note here that no criminal charges have been filed, and the bishop says he will fight the civil complaints in court. The leader of any religious community has the opportunity to be a powerful source of good, but we have long experience with the damage when that power is abused. Today, power, misconduct, and the pulpit. We'll look at what is unique about the abuse of power by religious leaders, what can be done to weed out predators, and how well-meaning clergy are being trained to navigate the complicated relationship between a pastor and his flock. If you're training to be a pastor, rabbi, or priest of any religion, how are you preparing yourself to use the power of your position well? If you've led a congregation for many years, what helped you avoid abusing power, even inadvertently? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later, NPR's Frank Langfitt visits No Man's Land. We'll talk about his reporting trip to Mogadishu, Somalia. But first, here to help us understand how and why religious leaders abuse their power and what's being done to teach new clergy to avoid the pitfalls is Yutha Hardman Cromwell. She's Assistant Dean at Wesley Theological Seminary here in Washington, D.C., and Professor of Practice in Ministry and Mission. At Wesley, Dean Cromwell teaches a course called Sexual Issues in Parish Ministry, and she joins us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And from KQED, our member station in San Francisco, we're joined by Rabbi Lawrence Kushner and the Emmanuel Scholar at Temple Emmanuel. He's also served for many years as an adjunct professor at Hebrew Union College and is the author of many books about Jewish spirituality. His latest is titled, I'm God, You're Not, Observations on Organized Religion and Other Disguises of the Ego. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Rabbi.
Good morning.
So, Ms. Hardman Cromwell, let me ask you first. Anyone who has power and authority could abuse it. What is unique when it comes to the clergy?
Well, one of the things that I think is unique when it comes to the clergy is that clergy are regarded as representatives of God. And so people very often give more credence to what they do and say than they might to other people. The other thing is that clergy have a kind of access that other people don't have. So as an ordinary person, you know, I can't just walk into your hospital room, for example, and start a conversation with you or so forth and so on. That would not be acceptable. But a clergy person can do that. A clergy person can enter into places where other people have to be invited. The clergy person can go uninvited.
Hmm.
And so I think that that makes a difference.
Right. Rabbi Kushner, what would you add to that?
I'm thinking of an image, probably the holiest object in Jewish worship is a scroll of the Torah, a handwritten scroll of the five books of Moses. And during worship services, rabbis routinely will carry that scroll around through the congregation, and everyone will want to reach out and either touch it or kiss it, perhaps with the fringes on their prayer shawl or their prayer book. And it's very, very easy, if you do that week in and week out, to get mixed up and start thinking that the reason that all those people want to be close to you is not because of what you're carrying, but because of you.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that can lead to some very dangerous psychological problems for a would-be religious leader.
Professor Hammond Cromwell, you're nodding your head.
Yes, I am, because, you know, I tell my students to take the sexual issues class that, you know, that the worship services give people, if they're really good, a kind of a high experience. The body doesn't know the difference between the source of a high.
Huh.
And so when you have people who are in your congregations who are single or single in relationship to that congregation because their mate does not participate, Or you have people, you know, I tell them sometimes when they haven't been hugged since the last week when you hugged them, you know, that people live alone and they live very isolated. And so when you make them feel really good in the service and they see you're the one that they attribute that I felt so good in worship today and have some kind of high experience, then they can attribute that to you and it can cause some interesting dynamic. So I tell them, it's not about you, you know, the same thing that he was saying. It's not about the clergy person.
That is so interesting. But now people do go to service, but you were talking about how the clergy can come into your lives uninvited outside the church, to your house, to a hospital bed. I mean, what do you mean exactly?
Well, what I mean is that people have access into your lives. I use the hospital as an example. But, you know, if I see a person who's a part of my congregation and I know that they're different from where they usually are, you know, maybe something's going on with them, you know, I would say, you know, how are you doing? What's going on with you? And so I'm much more likely to know when people are vulnerable because of some crisis in their lives, which could be something that isn't so visible to the rest of the congregation, like an illness or a death might be more obvious to everybody. But in all of those circumstances, I can make an entree into that person's space, psychological and even physical space.
Yes, Rabbi.
I served the congregation, my own pulpit in suburban Boston, actually not too far away from you, Dean Cromwell, for almost 30 years. And over all that time, people would start telling me things. And you just, I once, after having been there for a long time, was sitting up on the pulpit on the stage, at, you know, where everyone is looking at you and lots of ego problems can easily come from that. And I leaned over to the cantor and I paraphrased the way an old TV show from when I was a little boy said, there are 9 million stories in the naked city, and tonight is one of them. And I said to the cantor, I think I know one story about each person in this room. And it can do funny things to your head.
That's a power in itself right there.
Yeah.
Professor Harmon Cromwell, it is just so interesting to me that there is a class that exists, this class that you teach, Sexual Issues in Parish Ministry. Tell me about it.
I started teaching it when I put it together when I was at Howard Divinity School. I also got my MDiv degree there. And I did, because I was really interested in how the church wasn't dealing with sexual issues. So a lot of the things that I did in my classes when I had some freedom to choose my topic or whatever were around that. And I finally got the opportunity to put this class together. I'd been asking the school, we need to do something, you know. And I got a chance to put that together. And what I try to do, I tell the students who come into the class, I'm not trying to change your attitudes or about anything, but I want you to know about all kinds of sexual issues so that when you're out there, nobody comes, if I can help it, and of course there are always new things that are coming up, if I can help it, that anyone will come into your class and say something that you just knocked you right off your chair. I want you to have as much information as you can to help people and to respond appropriately when people bring issues to you. So that's the way the class is focused.
So seeing it coming is the first line of defense.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. We have several calls already. Let's hear from one now. Brian in, how do you say the name of your town in Florida?
Ocala.
Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Ocala, Florida.
Go right ahead.
Okay. One of the things, I'm a second-generation pastor. My father was a pastor, and I'm a second-generation pastor. And one of the things that I found out is that pastors, and a lot of times the members within the church, they do this. The pastors allow it, they pastors up on a pedestal, and the pastor becomes their father, becomes a big part of their life and in so many ways. And with me, with many counseling sessions that I've done, and you deal with many type of people that come through your ministries, pastors need to always, and this is what has kept me out of so much trouble, always make sure that if they're going into private counseling sessions, they need to let someone know. I'll say this quickly, and I'll listen from off the air. I remember on my way home one day, I was calling to check on one of my members that was, she had a stillborn baby in her belly, and she had a pot on, and I was checking on her, and she had three little children in the house, and I was going by to check on her kids. Her husband was at work. Before I went over there, I made sure that I got with my wife, and I got in contact with one of the deacons in the church to let them know that I'm going by this house to check this member because of the issue that is at hand.
Because you knew she was vulnerable. Is that what you're saying?
Say that again?
You knew she was vulnerable?
Not that she was vulnerable, but she was sick. She had a stillborn baby that she was waiting to pass. She was passing a baby that had died in her belly. And I needed to go by and her children that was at home because she could not move due to this, to the illnesses that was at hand. But I contacted someone. I made sure that I got in contact with her husband. I got in contact with my wife. I got in contact with one of my deacons to let them know that I'm in the area and I'm going by to check on this member. But this, someone else knew where I was, and this is what pastors need to do. They need to make sure that they put themselves in a position to where they are accountable to someone else and not just feel like they can handle everything on their own.
I see. All right. Well, Brian, thank you so very much for calling.
Okay.
We are going to talk more about power misconduct in the clergy, and we'll get more of your calls in a moment. If you're a pastor, rabbi, or priest, or if you're training to become one, how do you prepare? How do you avoid abusing your power, even inadvertently? Call us at 800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email. Our address is talk@npr.org. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Allegations of clergy abuse come in any number of forms: sexual, financial, psychological. One thing they all have in common: misconduct challenges every faith in many different communities. We're talking today about the complicated mix of power and spirituality and what's being done to prevent misuse of that power. If you're training to be a pastor, rabbi, or priest of any religion, how are you preparing yourself to use the power of your position well? And if you've led a congregation for many years, what helped you avoid abusing power, even inadvertently? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Yutha Hardman Cromwell, Assistant Dean for Wesley Theological Seminary here in Washington, D.C., and Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, Emmanuel Scholar at Temple Emmanuel in San Francisco. And we're going to start with an email we've got from Holly in Kansas. She says, "I've been the pastor of the same church for 20 years. It has been a gracious, rich, delightful, challenging ministry. I am a woman pastor, and even in a healthy, functional congregation, it is tough to hold the boundaries you need to hold. There are always folks who want to cross boundaries, who want to be too close, who want to give you gifts, etc. I hold firm but gracious boundaries with my church members by and through my ongoing work with my therapist. I am as angry as anyone with clergy abuse. But," she writes, "I also have to say, wow, dealing with 1,000 parishioners is not as easy as it looks. It is a relationship that is, as the speakers describe, like no other." And we are going to go to another call. Peggy is in Wickford, Rhode Island. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm so glad you're using the term power abuse. Because, and frankly, if these were women that Eddie Long had abused, we might still have a problem calling it power abuse. But I'm very glad, because that's what it is. It's not an affair. Even if it's two adults, it's not an affair because of the differential in power. I'm a clinical social worker. I've treated a number of people exploited and abused by clergy as well as therapists, doctors, et cetera. And there is a great resource on the web. It's called advocateweb.org, and it is for people who have been abused by clergy, professionals, sports coaches, any of those power differential relationships. And many people have said it saved their lives after they were exploited and abused.
Well, thank you so much for the call. Rabbi Kushner, do you have, you know, what do you have for rabbis in training?
Well, I think an important thing for everybody to remember, I first read it in the work of the great 20th century philosopher Martin Buber, who's famous for talking about, probably many people have heard of it, the I-thou relationship, in which two subjects meet one another and have a beautiful and a powerful sharing. But Buber is quick to point out that in the helping relationships, of which I think a clergy-congregant relationship would be one of the paradigms, they are by definition asymmetrical. One person has what the other person wants, and the dynamic of the relationship is that the person who wants it is trying to get it, and the minute that they get it, then the relationship technically ends because they become equal. But the problem is that the primary relationship is asymmetrical.
So can there be a consensual relationship? I mean, can that exist?
A helping, but all relationships have to be consensual, of course.
A consensual sexual relationship between a member of the clergy and a member of the
clergy? No, I think that's that would be terribly dangerous. And that would be especially because so much of the relationships between congregants and clergy are complicated by what the psychologists call transference. That is, in the case of a male rabbi, the congregant can easily confuse the male rabbi with his or her father and bring all that baggage that they have with their father onto the relationship with the clergyman. So it's very complicated, and the need, therefore, as one of the callers mentioned, strict boundaries is critical, essential in maintaining a healthy and healing relationship.
Okay, and we should say again that the allegations against Atlantis Bishop are allegations only at this point, and he has said he will fight them in court. Let's take a call now from Ed in San Antonio, Texas. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello. Hi, this is Ed. I can't hear you very well.
Okay, we can hear you. Go right ahead.
Well, my question is, for congregations that are searching for a new clergy person, they have search committees or things like that, couldn't it be a way to avoid the heartache of clergy power abuse to call a female clergyman? It seems to me that I've never heard a female clergy in these kind of sexual scandals like we have all heard with males. Now, maybe I'm incorrect, but I just want to inquire, is it a trait of female clergy that there is less frequent sexual scandal and the kind of aggressiveness that we see with male clergy?
Let's put this to Professor Yutha Hartman Cromwell, who's right here.
Well, one of the things that I think you need to consider also is that there are fewer female clergy than there are male clergy, even though that the numbers are increasing of female clergy. And I do agree with you.
I'm just asking, is it only a matter of ratio of female to male clergy?
Well, I was going to say that that I do not think that it is necessarily gender specific. But I do want to make a distinction between two situations. There are clergy who are predators. That is, that they are seeking out to use people for their own gratification. There are also clergy who get into sexual misconduct situations because they're looking for a mate. And those are two very, very distinct things. And so it would be very easy to have a male or a female person who didn't understand, if they weren't trained to do that, if they ignored the training, to look for a mate in their congregation and get into all kinds of difficulties in the congregation. But if a person is a predator, and you know, in general, in our society, you don't hear about female predators to the extent you do male predators. So I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be the same thing as far as clergy are concerned. So I would say that just calling someone who was a female clergy person wouldn't necessarily guarantee that you wouldn't end up with a predator. But I hope that you would call a female clergy on their own merits.
All right. Well, Ed, thanks for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's hear from Steve in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, go right ahead.
I'm listening to this. I'm very interested. I don't know if it's going to hit the nail on the head of what you're talking about, but the church that I grew up in California in the mid-70s wasn't necessarily the clergy abuse, but more or less the hierarchy, the families, the higher-standing families in the church who did, as I think back, I witnessed certain things happening that I was too young to put together at that time. And as time passed, there was a split in the church where the lesser, however you want to categorize it, were left at the church, and the other people that were the hierarchy, including the minister, left, leaving us at the home church made to feel, because these things happened to us, less than human. And I still have very, very strong Christian beliefs, but I do not like to participate in organized religions like this because I see things that I know might happen. And I don't know if this is following along the lines of what you're talking about.
I'm not sure what kind of abuse you're talking about. I don't want to get too explicit on the air, but...
Well, no, I attempted sexual abuse.
Okay.
Let's on my part that I saw these things.
Let's put this to Rabbi Lawrence Kirshner. Do you know when there are breaches of power like this, does it breed cynicism in the congregation? What how can you avoid that?
Oh, it's devastating for a religious community, for the congregation to have to confront the fact that their religious leader is not only human, but indeed perhaps a sexual predator. It can take congregations decades, generations to really heal from the pain that causes.
You actually came into a situation at your temple now. There had been a rabbi who left after allegations just a short time before. Is that right? How has that played out?
I'm happy to say I came in long after that was gone and don't have much to say about it.
Okay.
Except that it was a great tragedy, and the congregation brought itself together and is, I think, by and large, healed from that terrible chapter in its history. Mm. I mean, the big problem, of course, is, and I think perhaps many of your listeners might not realize this, is that for clergy people, certainly for rabbis, there is simply no time when a rabbi is out of role. The joke among rabbis is that going to the supermarket can be a work experience. The rabbis would say, you know, if you don't want to be a rabbi, you have to put on a disguise and go to a faraway country. And even then, somebody's going to spot you on the beach and say, Rabbi Kushner. So the role and all of the holiness and all of the power that goes with it can easily be confused as being who you are. And, of course, that's not who you are. That's what you do. And any rabbi, any clergyman, clergy person has to be keenly aware of that bright line between what they do for a living and who they are. And it's complicated by the fact that they're never out of role.
Okay. Thank you for calling. Steve and Professor Harmon Cromwell wants to add something.
Yeah, I want to say something to Steve, and I'm very sorry that is his name Steve?
Yes.
That he has he's moved away from congregations in general because of that, because not all congregations are unhealthy, but that's one of the dangers in people misusing their power, that they turn people off from the faith community, which is the place in which we can find our nurture and support, and we should be able to find it there. But I want to say something about, you know, he didn't say specifically that it was sexual abuse. I wasn't clear about
it. He said attempted sexual abuse.
But what I do see is a problem is that clergy can abuse congregations in other ways that are not sexual and train them, therefore, to accept abuse.
Like what? What do you mean?
Well, for example, I think that it's rather abusive when you encourage people to give beyond what is healthy for their family situation so that you can have an elaborate lifestyle, for example. Hmm. You know, that would be one thing that I would think of. Or the abuse of power, because we have, as clergy, the power, one of our bases of power is the power to reward or to punish. And so if you use that inappropriately, you can set people up to accept that this is what happens in church, abuse. And then you can revet it up to the sexual abuse at some point.
All right, let me just remind people that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we have a call right on this topic from Lisa in Nevada City. Hi there.
Hi. My issue was a power and prejudice issue with a pastor that I had been a member of the church for 16 years. And other women, I ran a singles group there, other women had come to me and told me that this was an issue, and I didn't believe them until it happened to me. My husband raped and beat me, and this particular pastor had done our premarital counseling. We moved away, and we lived away from the pastor for 12 years, and when the abuse became really bad and I separated from my husband, he went to that pastor and got counseling and came back and tried to force me to get back together with him. And when he tried to be abusive again, I slapped his face. And he went and got the pastor, who had become our neighbor at that point, and I slapped the pastor's face because the pastor kept telling me that I was a bad wife.
Oh, my.
And that Kevin did not abuse me. My husband did not abuse me, and I was a bad wife. And they had me put in jail for 9 days for slapping their faces. And my husband was never prosecuted for rape and beating me, even though I had a doctor's report.
That is so interesting. Let me get some, see if there's any reaction here from Rabbi Kushner.
I think the pastor committed a classic error, and that is not understanding that it takes two people to make a relationship.
Exactly.
And the moment he took sides, I think he violated one of the cardinal principles of pastoral counseling.
Yes.
So I'm very sorry for you, of course.
All right, Lisa,
and
thank
sorry
you.
For the pastor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Let's go to another caller now. Ubi is in Clearwater, Florida. Hi there.
Yes, hi there. Thank you so much for doing the show. It's an important and difficult subject, and I really appreciate the kind of information and clarity that your guests are bringing to share with us. My point, which actually goes back to one of your earlier callers regarding maintaining healthy boundaries, I just wanted to underscore that as something that has really helped me.
And you're a Unitarian minister, is that right?
That's right. That's right. I've been serving a congregation in Clearwater, Florida for 12 years now, and have encountered situations where that line tends to get a little blurry. And it's not just about counseling members who are going through issues, but also the issue of what is my role and what is the power that I carry. And how do I not only be attentive to that, but also use it in a way that benefits the community that I serve, rather than support me and my own ego needs? And one of the things that I have found helpful is the Code of Professional Ethics. That is a very important document that we who are members of our ministerial association are covenanted to uphold, both among each other as colleagues, but also with the congregations that we serve.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Obi. Professor Hartman Cromwell, are there different guidelines for different faiths? Where is kind of the regulatory overview here?
Well, in churches that are connected to each other in some kind of hierarchical way, and not just independent congregations, or loosely associated with an association, most of them that I know anything about have guidelines or policies about sexual misconduct and are now training their clergy. You know, they're required to come to training so that they understand. It is getting a little more expansive that seminaries are dealing with the issues, to make sure that their students are in some place or other in their curriculum dealing with the issue, so that they come to it with an understanding that because of the power differential, they should never be in a erotic, sexual, romantic relationship with anyone that they're in ministry with.
All right, and we're going to talk more about power misconduct in the clergy in just a moment. Plus, a rare glimpse inside what's been dubbed the most failed state. NPR's Frank Langfitt is just back from Mogadishu, Somalia. Stay with us. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Jennifer Ludden. We're wrapping up our conversation about power, misconduct, and the pulpit. Our guests are Yutha Hardman Cromwell. She's Assistant Dean for Wesley Theological Seminary here in Washington, and Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, Emmanuel Scholar at Temple Emmanuel in San Francisco. We have an interesting perspective here from a caller. Jan is in Newark, New York, and I understand you are a pastor's wife. Is that right?
Hi. Yes, I am. And I have two comments or issues that I'd be really interested in hearing your guests comment on.
Go right ahead.
One of my experiences as a pastor's wife has been in one particular congregation where in the course of conversations over the years my husband was there with various members, and in this case it was female members of the congregation, I would hear comments from them from time to time that made me realize that one of the things that seemed to be going on was that they were having what I would call a lot of fantasies about what would it be like to be married to a pastor.
And they would say this in your presence without realizing?
Yeah, actually.
Wow.
You know, they'd say, well, what's it like to be married to a pastor?
And a pastor in general, not necessarily your husband.
Yes, they would say it. They would usually couch it in general terms. And I think the question was on a couple of different levels. One, what's it like to be in the role of a pastor's wife, to be in one way in a very public role? And the other sort of unspoken question underneath that was, some sexual fantasizing about what's that like? So that's one issue. The other that I would be interested in hearing...
And if you could keep it just brief, we're coming up to the end of our talk here.
Okay. The other issue has to do with, if your guests could comment on what they see the role of clergy spouse being in...
Okay, sure.
In these situations.
Rabbi Kushner, go right ahead. Thank you for calling, Jan.
Yeah. There's an old folk saying in Judaism that says, if some guy comes along and claims he's the Messiah, ask his wife. I think that it's critically important for the spouse or the life partner of a clergy person to practice his or her own unique way of saying something like the following: I love you, but remember, you're still a jerk.
Keep him humble.
Well, it's very, because after a while, rabbis can dangerously start believing their own PR.
Right.
I'm reminded of a wonderful passage in the Talmud, which could come verbatim from an old Gary Cooper Western,
very
in which God says, there's only room enough here in this world for your ego and me. You pick.
All right, we have time for one more very brief call. Aaron in Little Rock, if you could ask your question briefly. Hi there.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to make one quick comment. I'm a youth pastor, and so not only do we have the ministerial power that you're talking about, but there's also kind of an age power that goes along with that, too. And in a conversation with a friend of mine, one of the things that we were discussing is that's so important to avoid abuse is to remember that at times you need to preemptively confess and to say, not that I necessarily am attracted or have any desire or want to create an abuse here, but that it's possible. To say, because we have, you know, these helping situations where we're coming alongside, not just clergy members, but minors as well, and saying, we recognize that this person is vulnerable.
All right. Yutha Hardman Cromwell, you're nodding your head here. The last word goes to you.
Oh, I was just going to say that I tried to tell my students that they need to know who they are sexually, that's one of the best things. They need to know who they're attracted to, what kind of person, because we're attracted to a type. They need to know themselves. And one of the things their spouse, if they have one, can do for them is they can help them spot the people that, you know, that they'd be vulnerable to. Because they know them, if they have, and they need to marry for themselves and not for the church, so that their needs can get met outside of the congregation.
All right. Yutha Hardman-Cromwell, Assistant Dean at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., and Professor of Practice in Ministry and Mission. And Rabbi Lawrence Kushner joined us as well. He's Emmanuel Scholar at Temple Emmanuel. His book is I'm God, You're Not, Observations on Organized Religion and Other Disguises of the Ego. He joined us from member station KQED. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And also to the many personal stories that listeners shared with us. We do appreciate that.